Good morning, everybody, and good morning, everyone in the room and on the webcast. My name is Rupert Trotter. I'm the Global Consumer Industry Specialist here at Barclays, and I have to say it's my absolute pleasure to welcome Altria back to the Staples Conference. My first time. I think many times you've been here. The group is once again very well represented by Altria CFO Billy Clifford. Billy, wonderful to have you here. General Counsel Murray, super to have you on the stage. And down in the crowd is Head of IR Bill. And that's absolutely wonderful. We could say lots of things about the tobacco sector at the moment, but I think that we've never seen a period of innovation that we're going through at the moment. And much to everyone's chagrin, in our summer holidays, the FDA also added a bit of spice to the sector. So plenty to talk about. We're going to be doing this in the context of a fireside chat. No fire, but bright lights. But if I can kick off, and then we'll look to very much open it up to the floor. I suppose if we could just start really at the sort of top level. Can you just put the Altria strategy in context for us, for those who perhaps don't know the company that well, and what you're looking to achieve perhaps on a 1 to 3 year basis?
Yeah, I certainly can. And first of all, I'd like to say thank you for the invite here and a chance to share our great company with everybody. From a standpoint of Altria, we consider ourselves a total tobacco play in the U.S. consumer industry. Our long-term financial objectives are to grow adjusted diluted EPS 7 to 9% through time, and then return a large amount of the cash that's produced by that back to shareholders in the form of dividends with our 80% dividend target payout ratio. We pursue those two goals with three primary strategies. The first is really to maximize the core tobacco businesses. We want to innovate, creating new income streams with innovative tobacco products. And then we want to manage those diverse income streams and that strong balance sheet to have consistent financial performance through time. The reason we consider ourselves a total tobacco play is we're represented in each tobacco category. So in the smokable segment, both cigarettes and cigars for us, we have the major brand Marlboro, flagship brand there. In the machine-made large cigars, we have Black & Mild. Of course, in the smokeless category, we have two great brands represented there by Copenhagen and Skoal. And then, of course, we have our other innovative tobacco products in our other segment. The other thing I would mention is we have a little bit over a 10% economic interest in AB InBev.
Well, hopefully we can come back to that as a side. But I suppose the key bit of news we really want to get to grips for, because it really does pertain to the U.S. primarily, is the FDA announcement. What more can you add to that, in particular, I suppose, in thinking about the sort of time scale and potential sort of gateposts that we as investors and those looking in from the outside might look for and gain comfort from?
Well, let me respond to that. And first, let me talk about what the FDA announced on July 28th of this year. We think that announcement is important for a number of reasons. First, the FDA embraced the concept of harm reduction. That is, the concept that some tobacco products are less risky than others, especially cigarettes. The FDA announced its intention to accept and to approve non-combustible tobacco products. And this is an approach that we have been advocating for years, so we're very excited about it. We're very encouraged by it. At the same time, the FDA raised the concept of a nicotine product standard. And, of course, product standards are not new. They've been on the regulatory table since the FDA took jurisdiction over cigarettes. We're prepared for it. We're ready to engage in it. But a couple of things should be kept in mind. First, all the FDA did was to raise the concept of a nicotine product standard. The FDA didn't come forward with a proposal, let alone a rule. And second, in order to convert a concept into a rule, the FDA is going to have to undergo the regulatory process, which is a very long process. It will take years. Any final rule will have to be based on science and evidence and be subject to judicial review. So this has proven to be a very long and uncertain process. So we think that the most immediate impact of the FDA's decision is this announced intention to go forward and to encourage the sale of non-combustible tobacco products, such as, for example, IQOS.
And Can you comment on what your interactions have been with the FDA since this point, or how the industry will approach it and how the conversation will bear out?
Sure. We have no further knowledge about how the FDA is going to be implementing its July 28th announcement than anyone else does. I think, though, again, we're hopeful that the FDA will go forward to encourage marketing of non-combustible tobacco products such as IQOS. We sell a number of tobacco products that are non-combustible that could be deemed harm reduction, such as smokeless and our e-vapor product, Nu Mark. With respect to the product standard, again, it's important to remember that the FDA has only come forward with a concept. There are many unanswered questions, both scientific questions and policy questions. If the FDA decides to move forward with that concept, the first thing that it would do is issue an advance notice of rulemaking. This simply creates a docket, opens up the FDA for comments from all interested parties as to what a possible nicotine product standard would look like. The FDA might hold some hearings. If the FDA chooses to go forward, it would come forward with a proposal. Again, there would be notice and comment, and certainly we would seize every opportunity to engage the FDA. If the FDA wants to go forward again with an actual rule, it would have to respond to the comments and issue the rule that would have to be based on science and evidence and subject to judicial review. The FDA itself correctly characterized this process as a multi-year process. Again, we think that the immediate impact is to encourage the sale of these non-conventional cigarette products, and we're very excited about going ahead and doing that.
Well, moving back slightly, but still at the top level to the sort of core business. Clearly, in terms of recent trading in the first half, I think you delivered about 3% earnings growth, but you very much reiterated your full year guidance within that, I think, which implies about 12% in the second half. What gives you the sort of confidence, and what are the underlying bricks to that so that we sort of hold our, so that we're confident that you meet those figures?
Sure. As you mentioned, we reiterated this morning at 7.5%-9.5% EPS growth year-over-year. To add a little color to that, I think it's important to look at both the first half and then the comparison. In the first half, the tobacco companies had excellent performance through the first half, and we expect that to continue. When you look at the year-over-year comparison, remember when the SABMiller AB InBev transaction closed, we changed to a one-quarter lag on equity earnings. What that meant was we had three quarters of equity earnings from that beer investment last year, and this year we'll have four as we move through the year. I think it's also important to remember in the smokeless segment, we had a voluntary recall that took place in the first quarter of this year. In the first half, we incurred about $60 million related to that recall.
Well, that's super here. Moving into the sort of smokeless sector, to say we can sort of really get stuck into the business. The volumes fell in Q2 in the industry by about 4.5%. I think there were some inventory movements. You were a touch below that. What lies behind the industry volume development at the moment, and how would you see that sort of evolving as we go through the year?
When you look at industry volume, it's important to look at it over a longer term. We tend to look at it over a multi-year period. I'll put it in that context, and then we'll talk about the most current period. When you look at it, historical decline rates in the industry have been about 3%-4%. We saw an exception in 2015 as we saw our tobacco consumer recovering coming out of the Great Recession. 2015 was somewhat of an anomaly, and at that time, we expected it to move back to its historical decline rate of 3%-4% through time. When you look at the most recent periods, the first quarter on an adjusted basis was down 3%, and the second quarter was down 4.5%. That increase quarter to quarter was really driven by California, the SET that took place there. Effective April 1st, the California state excise tax went up $2 a pack, and California represents about 7% of industry volume.
As regards California, let's sort of tick that box now. Clearly, they've put the tax hike through. To what extent do you think that can sort of be seen as a precedent that other states might look to follow?
I think it's important when you think about SETs or state excise taxes, they are always a threat to the company. Certainly with California, we saw that go through. I think it's important to remember with California because we have a great government affairs team that engages on these topics on a regular basis. The last time California had a state excise tax increase was almost 20 years ago. And so we do engage against state excise taxes when they're unreasonable. And so they're always a threat. But you can see through our history, even when we've had large SET increases, that we've been able to manage through pretty well.
Just staying with California, I'm sure you'll correct me, but they're also bringing, there was a local ruling as regards to go above and beyond the FDA on flavored and menthols, I think starting in April 2018. How do you see these sort of local movements impacting your business? And is this a trend you expect to see more coming to the fore from, I say, local governments to implement their own regulations above and beyond the FDA or ahead of them?
Well, we carefully monitor local initiatives such as that one. Our belief is that any further regulation should be done by the FDA. They have the expertise, and they have the ability to regulate on a nationwide basis. We take the position that it is far better to regulate on a nationwide basis than to have a patchwork of conflicting and confusing regulations governing tobacco products, not only on a state-by-state basis, but in the context of San Francisco, a city-by-city basis. So we carefully monitor that situation and engage when we think it's appropriate to do so.
Okay. Brilliant. Just going on into Marlboro, the key brand. Again, your market share has been very consistent. It fell back a little bit in the second quarter, and I think you indicated just in the second half we could expect more of the same. You've maintained that the share is sort of very consistently over the medium term. How should we be interpreting that in terms of the long-term evolution?
Yeah. We are very excited about the Marlboro brand, and we think it's very strong. We really look at the Marlboro brand. You mentioned share, but we look at four measures when we're thinking about Marlboro. We do look at share. That is one component. But we also look at profitability, and you can see through the first half with price realization and profitability coming out of the smokable segment very strong. We look at equity, the strength of the equity, and we have an annual study that we do on the equity. And there, Marlboro continues to be significantly exceeds all other competitive brands in the marketplace. And then we look at demographics. And so those are the four measures. And on demographics, once we put the Marlboro architecture in place, where we divided the Marlboro brand into subfamilies by color, red, gold, green, and black, we've seen the demographics level off and slightly improve through time. So we feel good about the Marlboro brand. You're right. In the second quarter, we did see some trade-off. Again, going back to that California SET, Marlboro was over-indexed, meaning its share in California was greater than its share on a national basis. And when you have that position with that type of state excise tax increase, you can expect, from a standpoint of the share of the brand, to be impacted by that.
Okay. So we're confident there. And so coming back onto just put California to bed, for want of a better expression, we've seen sort of move again in the legal age of smoking being moved up state by state. How has that, again, impacted sort of consumption patterns and consumption by age group?
We have not seen an impact on that. And again, we're monitoring it very closely. And again, we think that the legal age for using tobacco products should be set on a nationwide basis rather than state by state. But we have not seen an impact from the increase in some areas of the legal age to 21.
I mean, the other topic du jour we'll get onto is next generation, and we'll come to that in a second. But obviously, within the U.S., we are in that sort of post-consolidation period after BAT, RAI, and of course, Imperial. Can you make any observations on how the competitive tensions have changed and whether, I don't know whether you can comment on your peers in the space, but whether the RAI coming under the formal ownership of BAT has made any difference to their sort of commercial activities in the market?
I think it's important to remember when you talk about combinations is that we've experienced a number of these in the industry as it's consolidated through the years and performed quite well. The way we approach consolidations is really to run a multitude of scenarios so that we're always prepared to make adjustments in the marketplace when we deem it's appropriate. When you think about the competitive activity, it's always competitive, especially in the cigarette category. And we like to think of it as a band of competition. So, you know, you have a band that's somewhat normal, rational competitiveness that's natural in the cigarette industry on a regular basis. It may be towards the upper end of that competitive band, but nothing out of the ordinary from a competitive standpoint.
Fantastic. Well, let's move on to the innovation that's going on in the industry at the moment and the e-vapor platform. So, I mean, clearly it sort of dovetails into what, you know, where the FDA is trying to move us. But so can you comment about your aspirations here and the strategy and where you think you have the real strength?
Yeah, so from a standpoint is we know that a large group of our conventional cigarette smokers want less risky products. And so when you think about that, we want to have the best products in those categories. And our current platform is under the Mark 10 brand. And what it represents is it represents a number two market share position as of the end of the second quarter at about 13%. So when you think about Mark 10, that's in 65% or 65,000 stores where e-vapor volume is represented. When you look at the share in the stores where it's actually sold, it's 24%. So we think it's performing very well, but we want to take a disciplined approach in this innovative space, test and learn with the consumer, and really try to meet their desires with the products we put in the marketplace.
What do you think the catalyst for a sort of further acceleration of uptake of e-vapor is? Is it a technology? Or is it, I have to say, from the regulatory point of view, allowing a sort of understandable and long-term nature of the tax environment and therefore the total economics and incentives, therefore, for the corporates who sell them?
Yeah, I think you hit on the three things that we think will shape these categories as we move forward. The first is the technology. It's really meeting the consumer's desires and what they want out of the product. The second you mentioned was excise taxes. Excise taxes are virtually non-existent in the category currently, and we'll see how they shape out as we move forward. And the third is regulatory, from a standpoint of we had a delay just most recently in the deeming for those products in the marketplace.
Do you think that offers you an – sorry, Mario, you were
going to – I just want to add – let me just add that. This is what I was talking about before. I think the FDA will have – a huge impact on the success of that market. And that's why I think that the FDA announcement on July 28th was so profound, because the FDA essentially said that it was going to encourage the marketing of non-combustible tobacco products, and Mark 10 is exactly the type of product that the FDA was describing. So I think that the outlook for this market with the FDA's encouragement of it is terrific.
Do you think the FDA announcement also actually offers an advantage to the incumbents in the market in the short term due to the extending in the summit times for accepting new products and new innovations?
Well, I think what the FDA did, of course, is extended deadlines for submitting pre-market authorizations in the contact with respect to e-vapors till 2022. So those manufacturers with products in the market can continue to sell them till 2022, and if they submit a pre-market authorization, they can then continue to sell them after 2022 until the FDA decides on their applications. So in that respect, anyone who wants to put a new product on the market can't just do that. They have to first seek FDA approval. Well, those with products already on the market today can continue to sell them. So there is that difference, that grandfather effect, which has been, as I said, extended to 2022.
But actually, if we're trying to sit here and understand and evaluate the value, the long-term value of the cash flows associated with e-vapor and actual next generation, we've got to really wait till we understand the long-term tax framework, which seems intrinsically linked back to our friends at the FDA setting this new, effectively, framework within which they want to work.
And the tax framework will have to evolve appropriately, and it could be that at some point there's a difference in tax rates for those products that have gotten an MRTP able to make a claim under the FDA rules and regulations. We'll have to see.
Okay. So moving on to, I suppose, your relationship with PMI, but also, I mean, really IQOS. How do you see the landscape for that from here? evolving.
Yeah, we're very excited about the IQOS product and being able to launch it here in the U.S. We have an agreement with PMI that we have exclusive license in the U.S. for that product. We think it shows great promise. It has to go through the FDA process, of course, before we can bring it to market. Parallel to the FDA process, we set up a team internally to look at the commercialization process. Through the agreement and the relationship we have with PMI, we've teamed up with them to garner insights from the various markets where they've launched the product in the marketplace. Some of the things we've learned is that with that product, there's some education that needs to take place with the consumer. It's not as easy as tapping the pack and being able to light it. There is a little bit more involved with being able to utilize that product in the marketplace. That's one of the learnings. The other is the digital process that they have. We have a strong digital platform under the Marlboro brand, and so the team has really been working to see how they bring that digital capability to bear with the new product in the marketplace.
When might we be able to talk about sort of city trials and, in London, when we opened an IQOS store, there were, I think, sort of the first 100 people through the door from the investment community rather than from those looking to transfer out of one form of nicotine to another. When might we be able to see a store in wherever it might be?
Well, the FDA first has to approve the product. Under its guidelines, it has said that it will try to decide a PMTA within 6 months and an MRTP within 12 months. We're hopeful that the FDA will apply its guidelines and stick to its own timelines, and if it does that, we would expect to see a decision on the PMTA sometime early next year and a decision on the MRTP by the end of next year.
In terms of demographic appeal, again, if we were to look at the Japanese example of IQOS, it has been aimed at a more premium pricing point within that market. Where do you see the demographic attraction and potential growth lines for IQOS within the U.S. market?
From a demographic standpoint, that's exactly why we want to go to a lead market. There's a number of things we want to learn with the U.S. consumer. We get asked a lot, well, is it going to be more like this country or that country? Versus trying to extrapolate that, what we're really trying to do is garner those insights I was referring to so that we can apply them in the U.S. There are a number of factors that we'll learn once we get to the lead market. It's just a matter of getting it through the FDA so that we can commercialize.
I suppose this slightly hinges on that, but so what investments have you had to make ahead of a potential rollout in terms of capacity as regards preparing the sales force, which sales force it would go through?
Yeah.
The commercialization process?
Yeah, it's a great question. We haven't disclosed a lot around that agreement. I can tell you that as part of that agreement, PMI will supply both the device and the HeatSticks for the lead market, and then as things progress from there, we'll be in discussions.
Okay. I suppose the final point on that, sort of continuing on from it, in terms of capacity utilization, clearly Japan is a unique market, I think, for this product. In terms of, as they openly say themselves, they're being capacity constrained, the U.S. is a phenomenally large market. How do you see the capacity issue being managed, or is it, let's take this, if and when we get to the city trials, you'll be able to elucidate on that more?
Yeah, I think from a capacity standpoint, again, they've agreed to supply devices and the HeatSticks to us. I think you've seen them make significant investments through the recent periods to increase that capacity. We feel good about bringing it to lead market.
Brilliant. Okay. Just moving on very quickly, in terms of the other sort of forms, NGP, where are you looking in terms of, again, you've got the agreement with PMI on IQOS, but clearly there are the Platform 2, the Platform 3 from their point of view. Where do you fit in other forms of heated tobacco? Or is this, let's tick the first box first?
I think it's important to bring it to the lead market, to your point, and we can get the learnings there. When we look at, especially, Murray mentions the combustible, non-combustible statement by the FDA. We have a large smokeless business. You go to the e-vapor, and we have e-vapor, the current platform we have in the marketplace, as well as a pipeline of products that we can bring to the marketplace. We have the exclusive rights to heat-not-burn. We really want to have a portfolio of products that the consumer can then choose what they would like to engage with as an alternative to conventional cigarettes. I think we have a good representation across those platforms.
Superb. Moving on to capital returns and the balance sheet perhaps a bit. More recently, you increased the share buyback program a touch. Can you sort of discuss what lay behind that decision at that point? And I suppose I have to ask, was it impacted in any way by looking to meet that full-year earnings target?
I think you can look at the increase in our share buyback program as part of our normal course of business. You know, we've mentioned on our quarterly calls that we have the 80% dividend target payout ratio, and that takes priority from a capital allocation standpoint. Nothing's really changed. We did get the extra $2 billion from the ABI closing in cash, and that was included in the share repurchase previously. So this billion is somewhat of a normal course of business for us as we look at allocating capital and the cash that the company produces on an ongoing basis.
Brilliant. And then in terms of the, if I think about this in terms of net debt, EBITDA, what's the sort of benchmark that I should be thinking about sort of over the next few years?
We don't have any specific number in mind. As we closed the second quarter, it was 1.3 debt to EBITDA. And so when you look at that, it's important for us to stay investment grade, credit rating. We do access the commercial paper market about the March-April timeframe. We have three big payments that go out during that time of the year. We have the master settlement payment that goes out. We have a dividend payment, and then we have our final federal income tax payment. So we do want to be able to access capital markets during that time period to be able to utilize cash efficiently throughout the year. So staying investment grade is important to us, but no specific target as far as a specific number.
And in terms of CapEx looking long-term, with the advent of new products potentially sort of growing much more rapidly and becoming a more significant part of the group, how should we be thinking about that? I suppose I'm thinking on a 3-5 year view
rather than the 1-2. It's a great question. I think if you look at historical basis, our CapEx runs about equivalent to depreciation. So when you think about the size of the company we are, the capital expenditures are very, very tiny to the size of the company. But we do look at a 1 year, a 3 year, a 5 year, and a 10 year cash capital expenditure process to make sure we're never caught off guard from a standpoint of making the appropriate investments when it's necessary.
Okay. Just looking briefly at the smokeless area. I mean, again, you touched on the product recall in quarter one. The performance recovered sharply in Q2. Where do you see the business going from here? And what do you see the FDA's approach to, I have to say, smokeless, given in the light, if we think about people like Swedish Match, who've got long-term sort of scientific data that supports their positioning at a lower risk continuum. How do you see the growth in smokeless, and how do you see that actually in the marketplace and with the demographics?
I'll talk about the business, Murray, and then maybe you can talk about the FDA view. When you look at the business, there was a lot of noise in the first quarter, specifically across the with the voluntary product recall. So if you think about that in the first half, I like to think of things in a little bit longer context. So we exited 2016 performing very well. We had the product recall in the first quarter. And then if you look at the performance, growing almost 10% from an OCI perspective in the second quarter, I think you can see we put the product recall behind us. From a market share standpoint, Copenhagen's performing extremely well. We tend to look at the Copenhagen Skoal combined in the marketplace to really assess that we're performing correctly, and we feel like we are. If you think about the first half, we were probably about a half a share point impacted by the product recall that took place in the first quarter.
And in bringing new customers into the category, do you see this as an area of sort of increased, as the FDA gains and their proposals gain publicity and the focus becomes away, in their view, from a traditional FMC, are you seeing sort of uptake and trial increasing, or are there any changes we should see there in terms of the overall growth trajectory for the category?
I think we'll have to wait and see, and Murray will speak to the FDA process. From a standpoint of industry growth, we've seen it at about 2.5% industry growth over the last 6 months. From a standpoint, it's primarily made up of previous cigarette smokers that have traded over and converted over to the smokeless category. We feel good about the two brands we have in the marketplace, but we really, when you think about the margins and you ask about investments, the margins there are at the mid-60s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So very high margin business, but we feel like we're making the appropriate investments in the marketplace.
Yeah, on the FDA, obviously FDA, smokeless is a form of non-combustible tobacco product, and it would seem to be, from a harm reduction and spectrum of risk point of view, something that the FDA would encourage. The FDA did not specifically mention smokeless in its July 28th announcement. The FDA has gone forward and has granted a PMTA to some smokeless products. The FDA has not yet granted MRTP with respect to any smokeless products, but I think that process is simply beginning, and people are interested in that. So we'll have to see where the FDA goes with respect to smokeless.
Well, that's a pretty thorough wrap on the grid. I think with 9 minutes to go, I'd love to open this up to the floor, and I'm sure I hope there'll be plenty of questions regards all the activity within the group. So can I look to the floor, or I can? Right, I'll carry on.
Okay.
I mean, I suppose one of the most interesting things we're seeing at the moment, when we're looking at U.S. consumer overall at the moment, is sort of a bifurcation of the purchasing power of different demographics. Can you sort of share what you're seeing right way across the demographics you're exposed to at the high end and the low end, and whether there's, again, as we rolled off almost the sort of halcyon year of 2015 with the volumes only off sort of 2% to where we are now, and what's driving that and which demographics you see are most exposed?
Yeah, we certainly saw, to your point, we saw that recovery of our consumer in 2015, and that's where we saw industry volume almost flat for the year. As we progress, we feel like those economic factors that we watch are still a tailwind for our consumer, just not to the extent from a comparative standpoint that they were in 2015. So the factors are still pointing in the right direction. We get a lot of questions about the low end.
Yeah,
a lot of people ask, well, we see, if you will, the cheapest cigarette in the store, that share is growing, and that's correct. But we really break the industry into two segments, premium and discount. And then, so when you look at that discount category in total, it's flat to slightly down thus far through the first part of the year. Within that discount category, the cheapest in the store, or what we call deep discount, is growing, but it's offset by branded discount, like L&M, Pall Mall, Maverick, those types of brands. I mentioned L&M, which is our representation in that category, and it's performing very well and doing exactly what we want it to do, which is accumulate share within the discount category without growing the overall discount category in the industry. So our consumers there, we're hearing it a lot across other categories, that consumers are under pressure, and we're monitoring it and keeping an eye on it, but we haven't seen anything that would point in that direction at this point.
So the shape we're in at the moment is what we should be expecting to, this is a trend we can expect to see in terms of the portfolio evolution as well, looking forward.
Yeah, so we feel good about the portfolio and the approach to the marketplace. One of the items we watch is gas prices, and of course with the unfortunate activities that took place in Houston related to Hurricane Harvey, and our thoughts go out to those affected, we could see gas prices pop up, and we've seen a little bit of that. But again, from a standpoint of overall impact and the economic factors as a tailwind to the consumer, they seem to be pointing in the positive direction for us.
A question that I know I have to put to you because many of clients I speak to sort of ask about it is sort of thinking about sort of future evolution of the sector at the corporate level. There's been much chatter about sort of further global consolidation, and clearly with the advent of NGP as well, yourselves and PMI. Can I just ask in a very open way, what need would you ever see for this, and see if we can dispel the myths and rumors?
I think I know where you're going with
yeah.
this question.
So I'm trying to ask it open-ended.
And I appreciate it, but we really don't speak to future mergers,
right.
acquisitions, or anything in that category.
Right.
So I appreciate the question.
Right. Yeah. Okay, superb. Well, I think at that point, can I open it up once again to the floor for questions? Brilliant.
Volume trends specific to the cigarette category? Yeah, so historically we've seen it down about 3 to 4% in that range. When we think about volume, that 3 to 4% is made up of two factors. One we call secular decline. What that represents is people that leave the category, people that switch to other products. And then the remaining part of that, and that's about, you know, 1%-2%, 2%-3% in that range for secular decline, that people that's the churn. The remaining piece is price elasticity, and that's historically been a negative 0.3 in relationship to pricing. So as we entered this year, the first quarter was down 3% on an adjusted basis for the industry. Second quarter was down 4.5%, but was influenced by the California state excise tax that took place and was effective April 1st. So again, when we see large SETs in any given state, if you look at the states that have done it previously, you always see a disruption in the marketplace as the consumer digests that price increase. It's just a matter of time. The historical trends always return back to the negative 0.3 price elasticity. It's just a matter of how long does it take the consumer to digest that price increase in the marketplace. Again, it's very early to get into those pieces. Recall, as part of the agreement, PMI will be providing the heat sticks and devices, especially for the lead market. And again, we plan pretty far out. So we look at 1, 3, 5, and 10 so that we're never caught off guard. And so as this continues to develop, we'll be in discussions with PMI so that we are assured between the parties that we have the capacity to meet demand.
Just continuing the conversation actually on volumes and the price elasticity, how do you see the relationship in terms of pricing between the next generation products, the e-vapor, let's use that one that's in the market at the moment, smokeless, and FMC evolving, particularly again as we don't have visibility on potentially the long-term tax structure around sort of some of the newer segments of the market?
Yeah, I think there'll be a lot that'll be evolving as we move forward, but just to put it in relationships. So if you think about the total tobacco industry, $80 billion, cigarettes making up the larger portion of that from a consumer expenditure standpoint, north of $70 billion. We saw last year e-vapor at $2.5 billion. So we know there's some interplay, if you will, between the cigarette consumer looking at the e-vapor devices. But again, nothing to the magnitude of what cigarettes represent in the marketplace.
So at the moment, the price elasticity between the two, the switching driven by pricing, is less of a factor. When do you see that coming? Is this something we need to be conscious of in our modeling and how we think about the industry evolving?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something we monitor on a regular basis to make sure that we understand the price elasticity across categories. It's something that we're trying to tease out, but because e-vapor is such a small representation to the overall cigarette category, it's hard to tease that price elasticity out. We do see that when you put trial, people put coupons or free devices for people to try in the marketplace, that does induce trial for the consumer to want to try the products. But outside of that, there isn't a lot of that we have on price elasticity cross category.
And just to follow up on the question actually on the volume performance in the beginning of the year, and obviously California, how has California combined with actually the FDA ruling impacted your view on pricing per se in the industry this year, but actually more as we go through this, what is going to be, seems going to be a fairly iterative process over the next however long it is, 3-5 years. How do you think the industry is going to respond in terms of pricing on FMC during that period?
I can't speak to future pricing, but let me at least describe the way it occurs in the past, and I think that's a good representation. If you think about price realization in the cigarette category, it's between 4 and 5%. Yeah. I think you've seen through the first half of this year, it's been at the upper end, and that includes the effective SET increase in California and everything else associated with the FDA. So that 4 to 5% has been a very good place for the cigarette industry to be over on a historical period, and then most recently at the higher end of that.
So the message is there's no change in terms of the pricing power in your view of your portfolio in the industry context.
Again, I can't speak to the future, but I can certainly.
At present. Brilliant. Well, at that point then, unless anyone has any more burning questions, shall we move? Firstly, I'd like to thank Billy and Murray and Bill. For their comments up here on stage, but let's move through to the breakout session.
Okay. Thanks
Thank you very much indeed.